I'm Jan Suk Fong Lee.
And I'm Dina Del Bucchia.
And this is Can't Lit. Can't Lit. Talk about books and
stuff. Hello and welcome to Can't Lit. You know what it is. You love it. You listen to it. You sometimes late at night are lying in bed thinking about it and you're like, I should be sending Dina and Jen money for doing this free podcast. So just keep that part in mind always. We always want you to be thinking that. And maybe one day there'll be an opportunity for you to do that.
You can just think about sending us money in the meantime.
Yeah, just consider it. This is episode 99. So pretty exciting.
Oh my God. So exciting.
I was making up a song earlier today about how I just want someone to pay me to stay home and do puzzles and write my stupid little books.
And Isn't that what we all want?
Yeah, and I was singing it really loud. And somebody else who lives here was like, that's very annoying. And then I said, do you want me to go back to the other song where I was singing about how you have a beautiful angel face surrounded by flowers? And he said, no. So, you know what? You can't pick the songs that you get to hear when I'm around. Anyway, this is all unimportant. What's very important is that I'm super hyper today for no apparent reason. But even more important, we have an absolutely incredible guest. We are so lucky to have her. Award-winning writer, editor, publisher, icon, and an absolute delight, Casey Plett. Casey's new book is A Dream of a Woman and is out now with Arsenal Pulp Press, permanent friend of the podcast, Arsenal Pulp Press.
Also recently longlisted for the Giller Prize, totally. Or Governor General's. Oh my God.
Giller.
No, the Giller.
Longlisted for the Scotiabank Giller Prize.
You got to get the bank in there.
Exactly. Hi, very important. Hi, Jen. Hi, Dina.
Hi.
Hello. It is wonderful to be here. I'm so thrilled this is finally happening.
This is very, I know. We have wanted this for years, and now finally we are all together.
And the 99th episode. My goodness. This is the Wayne Gretzky episode, obviously.
Yeah, this is the Wayne Gretzky episode.
Absolutely.
Imagine if I had a bottle of Wayne Gretzky wine and I just opened it right now and started drinking right out of the bottle.
I think it's vodka, actually, isn't it?
Oh, there's wine.
Which would make it even better.
I've had the wine. It doesn't taste very good.
Wayne Gretzky also makes a bourbon. It's not good. I accidentally bought it once because the bottle looked like another bourbon, and I accidentally bought a Wayne Gretzky bourbon. I gotta say, it's very bland, as one would expect.
That is so funny.
That is hilarious.
You know what? He had his heyday. He had the most beautiful mullet in the world.
Uh-huh. What is the thing about, like, when you, like, retire from sports, you, like, either, like, open up a restaurant or you, like, make, like, food or booze or something, like... I feel this is like a really common like ex-sports career path.
Absolutely.
I also know nothing about sports. I think you're correct.
And okay. I'm sure it's just because there's only so many things you can market, right? Like, what are you going to sell? You know, if you don't want to go on speaking tours all the time or become a commentator, or what else can you do? Become a coach or a manager. You just got to peddle some products.
I mean, you're either selling so. Tim Hortons coffee or
George Foreman grill.
Good point. Oh my
goodness. I actually had a George Foreman grill in the 90s. It was pretty good.
Oh my goodness. What did you make on it?
Mostly paninis.
There you go.
I mean, that was
perfect.
That's the time everyone had to have a panini.
What's up? Thanks, George, and all your children also named George.
All the children named George. Oh, boy. Well, what a wonderful intro to this. I mean, all of this is super relevant to everything we're going to talk about today, so I'm glad that we have covered it. So, Casey, what's happening with you?
What is happening with me? I just had a really good brunch. I had salmon, eggs, Benedict.
A classic brunch.
Exactly. Really, really good. If you want to know what's going on in my life, my book is coming out on Tuesday, which is feels really nice, which feels really good. I am living in Brooklyn right now. I'm teaching at Rutgers Newark, and life is good. Life is good. I don't have a lot to complain about. What else is going on with me? I'll tell you, it's weird. So this book is coming out, like, technically the pub date's in, like, Tuesday. And, like, I've never had this amount of time between, like, when I finished a book and when the book actually came out. So, like, I finished, like, proofs of the book in April. And I've never had, like, this long of a lead time. It's always been, like, my other two books, they just kind of, like, came out as soon as I was done with them. So it almost feels like, oh, yeah, I wrote that thing. Like, that's interesting.
Yeah, you had, like, this, like, little break to not be writing or thinking about it. And now you're just thrown into promotional book cycle.
Yeah, exactly. And it kind of feels like, it almost feels like we're like, oh, yeah, like those people, like, like those guys, what the hell are they up to? What are they doing?
What are they doing?
I know. So, like, yeah, kind of cool. I also kind of feel like I have a bit more distance on it. So that's also kind of nice.
That is nice.
Yeah.
Jen, what's happening with you?
All I do is read. The only other thing I do is, this is a true story. All I do is I literally read for work and I read for fun. And the only other thing I do for fun is I've been, like, deep frying a lot of things lately. So I've been deep frying Brussels sprouts and, like, donuts and, like, dumplings. And this is what I do to meditate. I stare at bubbling hot oil and I throw things in it.
That sounds amazing.
Ah, it's not bad.
That sounds really therapeutic. Like, also the eating part, but also, mm-hmm. like, the tossing things in hot oil part.
Jen, I can't wait to come over.
We're gonna deep fry Brussels sprouts for Dina.
Yeah.
What's happening with you, though, Dina?
Well, let me tell you. Yesterday, I got a new mattress pad, so pretty exciting stuff is happening over here. and egged on by a former guest, friend of the podcast, Sanara Geisler, I started a Substack newsletter for no reason. It's called Hey Fuckface.
Amazing. That's such a good name.
And I have no idea how I'll use it. I did post once, or if I'll even update it, but just knowing that I have Hey Fuckface in my back pocket just makes me feel good. So, yeah, I've got Hey Fuckface ready to go if you want to subscribe.
Dina, did I ever tell you that Hey Fuckface is what I call the North Face, like the brand of outdoor clothing? Every time I see the North Face, I say Hey Fuckface. Seriously.
Honestly, that's incredible.
Yeah.
That is so beautiful. Wow.
Lovely.
Wow. Jen, you're always on the pulse of what people want and need. Speaking of being on the pulse of what people want and need, let's talk about this incredible book. Again, I feel like, again, same as last episode, Jen and I both were like, before we recorded, this book is incredible. We love it. We were enthralled. We're very excited to talk to you about that you wrote a fucking awesome book.
It's so good. So good.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's get into it.
I'm going to tell you what I love about it, Casey. What I love about it specifically, I love a lot of things about it. The biggest thing for me is that there's so much, like, emotional sincerity in this book. And it's and that kind of truthfulness or authenticity of emotion, which sometimes, like, I get annoyed with irony. Like, it really gets on my nerves. And then I was reading A Dream of a Woman, and I'm like, all of these emotions feel crystal clear, and they're like, it feels like I feel like I'm in safe emotional hands with Casey Plett, is what I feel like.
Well, thank you.
And so, like, yeah, and, like, the question is actually, do you feel like you're a cynic? Because I don't see cynicism here at all, right? But I'm wondering, how do you feel, like, as the author? Because to write these things, I would think that you also feel a lot of emotional sincerity, but then I'm reading too much into it. And then I'm like, no, maybe Casey is a cynic and I just don't know.
Man, that is like, That is one of the most thoughtful and generous questions I've ever been asked. Thank you for that. Man, I think I would say that, like, I do feel very cynical about lots of stuff a lot of the time, but I think I feel like fiction writing is almost like a place where I kind of feel like I can get away from that. And it's also like I definitely don't want to, that's just like not a space I want to inhabit when I'm making stuff or when I'm, one thing I realized some years ago is that I didn't want, this maybe ties into your question as well. Like, I didn't want to make fiction with characters that I hated or disliked. Nothing against it. Like, I read plenty of fiction where, like, I don't like the characters and I can tell the author doesn't like the characters. Like, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. But, like, that's just not, like, what drives me to write fiction, I think, doesn't really compute with the part of me that wants to be cynical or the part of me that doesn't like characters and doesn't like people. You know what I mean? Like, if I'm going to write them, if I'm going to put them in there, then they're probably there because I love them in a certain way. Even when, again, when they're characters who do bad things aren't necessarily people I want to be friends with in real life. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. This is so funny that was Jen's first question, because one of my questions and something that I loved about the book and what I literally wrote was that both Jen and I love this. So again, speaking for Jen, but I think all of these characters are really grappling with complex, nuanced, and sometimes ugly emotions, the ones that are hard to face. And these characters are not neat or, you know, tidy people, and neither are the emotions that you are allowing them to experience in the book. So kind of following up on that, you know, my question, Jen and I talk about this all the time. We both love it, but how do you get to the bone of those emotions when you're writing these characters?
Man. Thank you. I would say there's like sort of like two folds of it. The first is that the first answer is somewhat ephemeral, and the second one is maybe a little more like nuts and bolts. The ephemeral one is just that, like, I don't know, divine inspiration, gosh. But what, you know, what that actually looks like is all of a sudden I'm really like sad or upset about something, or just like, and then like, and it's either based on something that happened in real life or something that like, is like a conglomeration or a mashup of a bunch of things or something that happened years ago. So whatever, wherever like, sad people writing their sad stuff, wherever that comes from is the first answer to your question. I don't know if I have anything, deeper than that about it. The second one, I think, that's a little more nuts and bolts, is I'll often be in like either the middle or later stages of writing fiction. And then I'll be like, why can't I solve this, or what's wrong with this? And the question, and the answer is always like, because whatever the truth of this is here, isn't something that I want to face, or is something that I want to ignore, or is something is like that is not, that I would rather not have to think about. And if I wanted to, you know, maybe like your Jen's question about cynicism, like, there's plenty of other places in my life where, I can, you know, ignore hard truths and like pretend things are simpler than they are and like paper over stuff and just like, be irresponsible and not tuned into any more complicated thing of my life. But like fiction writing, just like not. Like, it's sort of like in part of the raison d'etre that, I have to sort of like follow that to the end. And sometimes that's been like really like for example, with the first story in the book, Hazel and Christopher, I was working on that story for years and I was stuck like halfway through and I kept thinking like, why can't I finish this? And the whole idea was like, well, I mean, like, I guess Christopher could also actually secretly be a lady, but no, I don't know. And then I was actually like, after a couple of years, like, no, I just really don't want that to be the case. I just really, really don't want that to be how the story ends, but that's how the story actually ends. And I was able to complete it. This is sort of a bleaker thing, but in my novel, Little Fish, there was a character of Sophie who midway through dies by suicide. And I had a whole other arc for her, and I kept trying to finish the book, and nothing was working. And eventually I was like, the reason this isn't working is because she's not alive for the second half of the book. And like, that was a really, really like shitty thing to have to think about. And I was like, I don't want to write this. This is like not, I don't want to do this. Like, why am I doing this? Why? I was like, oh, I'm going to quit writing. This sucks. And I was like, but that is the truth of what's happening here. And so like, and I have to reckon with that. I like to like write that part of the book. I literally like went away for a week and like didn't talk to anybody. And so, yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, again, I think that fiction writing is sort of like the one place in my life where I tell myself, like, I don't want to let myself be cynical. I don't want to spend time with people that I don't just like really love and care for in some way. And I don't want to ignore whatever the complicated truth is. And that's just kind of like, the way I've been able to finish stuff. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think it's just something really good for writers to always remember. Like, you know, all of us have I think mentored people and tried to instill some kind of literary wisdom. And I think that's a really good one always keep in our back pocket, like that writing those hard parts is actually the most important thing. And it sucks that it's hard and it's a lot of work.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
But go on.
Oh, I was just going to say we had I think Alicia Elliott on years ago, and I was asking her, cause I was just starting to write memoir and nonfiction. And I was asking her what was her best piece of advice. And she said, if something's not working, it's because you're not exposing what needs to be exposed. That's always it. And you have to go deeper. And I think that works for fiction too. Like, don't you feel like we sometimes writing, we have to bring our, you know, all of our empathy, and we have to bring all of our understanding of what being like alive in the world is to our writing in a way that, I mean, I'm only speaking for me, that I don't bring to my real life. Let's be honest. I'm not this good a person in real life.
Right? Totally. Yeah. Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what I tell myself in the mirror every day. I don't. But no, that's absolutely true. Yeah. It's also weird for me because I feel like with poetry, I can do it so much more easily than when I'm writing fiction.
Interesting.
And
go on, I would hear more about that.
I think for me, it's because poetry is always... the seed is always something that I feel like I can explore without really judging myself. And I feel like no matter what, when I'm writing fiction, I think I don't let myself run away with things like I would. And so I think it's like it's a weird formal thing in my brain. I don't know, but
that's wild.
And I try to, and I think when my fiction works for me, and hopefully other people, but it's when I'm tapping into that as well. I don't know. It's weird.
I would say with poetry, there's layers of opaqueness or opacity that doesn't happen in fiction as much in terms of like language, but also device. That's my experience anyway. Like I just said I was writing memoir, but I typically don't write about myself, but with my poems were more about myself than anything else I had written before that. So like, I sometimes think that those layers of language allowed me to feel some freedom to say the things that I had never said before, if that makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense.
And the level of experimentation I feel like that I can do, or that I just will naturally start doing in poetry, is so different than what I will do when I'm writing fiction. And also if you write a poem and it's a shorter poem, you can just like move things around so quickly and easily and see the connections. And when you're writing something longer that's in prose, it takes more to even visually unpack it and like look at the component parts. you know, the organizational structure is different.
Really? That's so funny. Cause poetry always, I mean, like, I'm not a poet. I've never written poetry. I love reading poetry. Can't write it. I always thought poetry seemed harder to me in that way. So that's fascinating to hear that you.
It's harder for me that way. It's harder for me that way. It's easier for Dina that way.
This Amazing. Is just like my explosive emotional Italian vibe, maybe. I don't know.
You just mentioned structure. I actually wanted to ask Casey about structure.
This is another great question, which I also have, and I'm excited to hear you.
Okay, because I think with short story collections, people don't talk about structure as much as they do with novels. And
totally.
Right? And I've edited short story collections, and I've gone in there and like done things with structure. But what I find so interesting about this book is that there are what I feel like long stories that are cut up and then like, or featuring mm-hmm. the same characters that are cut up and then sort of interspersed. So I guess, how does that idea of that structure and that sort of like circling around these same characters, like my question is, why did you do that as opposed to like just saying, like, it's the David Vera story that I think is the longest. Yeah. Why that wouldn't, you know, and a lot of short story collections will like back end that, like they'll put the longer sort of novella length thing at the end as the last story in a collection, and that's what one would expect. So I guess my question is like, why did you do it this way? I love it because also because I love Vera and I really want to
me too
I want her to be good.
Right.
Yeah.
Me too
Yeah. Thank you. Absolutely.
Okay, I'm going to answer again with an ephemeral answer and a nuts and bolts answer, because they are both true. The ephemeral one is that just, like, it just sort of, like, came to me as I was going. But, like, really, I mean, like, I definitely feel like sometimes when I read, I can tell when the writer, like, planned something to be a certain length, and it didn't really work out that way, but they were, like, committed to the bit, and I can kind of tell when something like that doesn't always work out, you know? So I always try to pay really close attention to like the length of things as to what sort of feels like, what really feels to me like where the energy is, where it's starting and stopping. And with Vera's story with Absolution, it felt very like that was only going to be like one regular length story, like about 20 pages. And then I wrote like the first chapter of it and I was like, oh shit. Like, I think I have a lot. I think there's a lot more going on here. I think I'm going to have to write a lot more about this. This is going to be difficult. Damn. And it felt like so, it like split up so neatly in those five chapters because we sort of like drop into like five very like cleanly separate parts of her life. The nuts and more nuts and bolts answer is that as I was putting the book together, I sort of realized that Vera, like, I think the book almost sort of seemed to me to have like two tracks, and the first track is Vera's story, and the second track is everybody else. Like, because in everybody else, the narrator, the protagonists are all like around, they're in their mid-30s, they're people who are trans women who have transitioned kind of a while ago. They're all struggling with alcohol. They're all pretty broke. Vera, none of those things are true. It's a different thing. And so it kind of said to me, like, how, like, who is Vera going to become? Like, what's her life going to be like? And even though, like, I don't think Vera was ever, like, Vera never struck me as someone who sort of could end up in the situation that the other girls end up in, but her story seemed to be, like, an interesting contrast to all the other stories in the book. So, So once I thought of it that way, the whole structure of the book like really fell into place. And I think of the ending of the book's questions and the book's themes as very much like the last chapter of Absolution and then the story Enough Trouble. I think of those two sections of the book as like, this is hopefully sort of like closes all the things that the book has addressed. Does that make any sense? Does that mm-hmm. answer your question?
I love this idea of like the two sort of narratives on parallel lines. Because that's the way I described my first novel, was that it's parallel lines and these protagonists uh-huh. are just move, but they don't really interact, but they're just kind of like, and I think that's a really interesting way of like, that's not a structure shape that we learned in school. but I think it should be.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We're all teachers. We are now going to tell all of our students to write this way.
Yeah, we're gonna call it the train track structure.
Absolutely. Calling it right here. I like it. Good coining.
I love it. You're both great. As well, there's other characters that have stories split up
outside
of Vera's story. Mm-hmm. And it was also interesting as a reader to be going through, as you're kind of saying, these two tracks, and then we're seeing these characters also take breaks from their lives and from the lives of the other characters that they interact with as well, which also to me, like, structurally gave the whole book, I don't know, like there's just so much of that. Like, again, I think this goes back to the topic of the emotionality of the book. Like, it just felt very, real. It felt very natural for those breaks to be happening, because people do have breaks in their relationships with people in parts of their life. And so on that level, it really worked as well.
Thank you. That means a lot to hear. Cause like a lot of the, something else that I was really interested in with the book was this idea of recursiveness, like of this idea of like things that kind of like keep like repeating over and over in a character's lives. And I especially think with someone like with Vera, but also the rest of the characters, actually, when they were younger, when they thought about like, what is my life going to be like? What am I going to, and like, what am I going to have to deal with? Those things are all scrambled. So there's things where the character is like, wow, like I didn't think that this would ever happen. And then it did. And there's also like, I can't believe I'm still dealing with this shit after like I thought this was going to be like, I didn't think this was going to be a permanent part of my life, but all of a sudden I woke up and it was. And that also extends to things like, yeah, like things like relationships, where like this relationship between Vera and Iris are these two people sort of like can't get away from each other. Even though their relationship sort of like takes all forms over time. Anyway, I'm glad you felt that way. Thank you.
Yeah. Also, I feel like you're super good at writing swearing. Yeah! And I feel like you need to give a brief masterclass in like brilliant poetic profanity.
Oh my God.
And I love that you are like, you're the kind of writer that can use it both for comedic effect or also the opposite. And that truly is a skill. And I think overall you're great at writing dialogue.
Yeah.
And I love well-written dialogue. I can't get enough. So what's important to you when you're writing dialogue?
Shit. Thank you. I'm just like taken aback by the swearing compliment. I'm just like still processing it. I'm gonna like ride for like a few days on that compliment.
I can pull this out and like make a little audio for you to just have.
I'm gonna make it my little like alarm on my phone now. Yeah. So that I just like wake up like with like Dina telling me that I'm good at swearing. Like, it's gonna be great. I think with dialogue, I feel like I very much have like a reduction thing, where there's Grace Paley, this like old chestnut about like, I think it's something like, dialogue is not conversation. Dialogue is conversation's greatest hits. And so when I thought about that, I thought, well, when I'm writing dialogue, what I'll often do is I'll write what I actually imagine the conversation to be. And that includes all the like the awkward ums, ohs, so much of sort of what's going on. Oh, I'm okay. Wasn't it hot? Oh, blah, blah, blah. Like all the really uninteresting and important stuff. And then I will take that and sort of like edit and snip it down and kind of try to like create something out of it. But I usually try to start by writing what the actual conversation would be, even if I know that like 90% of it is boring stuff that I'm going to cut later.
That's awesome. And I did not know about this Grace Paley quote, or summary of it, is so good.
It is a good one, right?
It's really, really good. Yeah.
I think sometimes we have to write dialogue with all that other sort of boring filler stuff sometimes, only to be cut later, because we have to warm up as writers. Like, we have to warm totally. Up to the conversation. Yeah, like a real conversation.
Right, totally, totally. Kind of like how, like pitchers kind of, like, in the bullpen, they kind of, like, start off throwing softballs.
Where they yeah. We got to yeah. practice our dialogue. Yeah, exactly. Also, too, there's, and then yeah. I think, too, when you have tight dialogue or dialogue that's very specific, then when something is, like, the boring thing, you're like, oh, it's because that's that character. Like, this is not a complex character. This is how right. that, you know what I mean? So, like, I think then that also can show the contrast of that, I don't know, the way certain people speak.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Also, voice, too. Like, there's really strong voice work throughout, like, for all of the characters. And it felt really fitting because this book was, in so many ways, I think about the different ways of exploring love, like, you know, friendship, family, love of ourselves, and also the opposite of that in all of those instances. And I think having a really strong voice allows you to explore that idea in a variety of different ways. So yeah, you obviously were thinking about love when you were writing this book, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I was,
yeah. Uh-huh. I don't have a question now. I turned away from my notes for 2 seconds and then I just started going off. But I mean, sure. Yeah, like, I mean, if you want to think about that as sort of, you know, like, how does that connect to the way that you approach the book or.
Yeah, it was the kernel of it. I think it was when, I finished the first story, Hazel and Christopher, and I thought, man, I think I might have a lot to say about, like, love and relationships. I think I might be writing a book about that. That's, goodness gracious me. but it was very, like, I don't know, my, I was thinking about, like, let's see, when did the kernel for this book start? It was, like, about a little over 2 years ago. So my best friend and also ex, Sybil Lamb, also a writer and artist, very talented. She, I was just moving back in into the house that we share, in Windsor. At the same time, my father, who had split up with his partner, had also, come to Windsor and that around that same time. And he was living with us for a while and he was kind of like getting back on his feet. And I was living again, with my ex Sybil. And so I was thinking about all these things of like, well, like these like very complex adult relationships that don't really map onto how that can be like really powerful and very like bonding, but don't really map on how like these like linear sort of like relationships are supposed to go. And yeah, I don't know. I found like, I really wanted to talk about like what happens when you, like with Nicole, for example, in the two Windsor stories, she's someone who has these, she has two separate incidences with, both a guy in the first story and a girl in the second story where she is attracted to this person, they're attracted to them, and she goes like, actually, but like I can already see that I don't actually want to be with this person, I just think that I do, or I would like that to be the case. And she has, and even though she's like terribly lonely, she like removes herself from that situation. That's the kind of stuff I was thinking about. I don't know if I have a succinct answer to that question. But that was the kind of stuff that was all sort of like circling in my head as I was writing the book. And then I think Enough Trouble, which I sort of, even though it's the penultimate story, I kind of consider it the final story. With Enough Trouble, I felt like I really had to answer the question, like what would it have to take for one of these characters to end off at least attempting to cohabitate with a romantic partner in a way that felt truthful. And it took like, how long was that fucking story? It took like 84 pages to get there. 84.
Yeah. I guessed that it felt like an 80-page story. You are so correct. As a short story writer, I was like, that's the vibe. It's the 80-page story.
That's right. Absolutely. I'm really into like long short stories. I talked with someone the other day, right? I was talking to someone the other day and I was like, that story is pretty short. It's like 20 pages. And I was like, fucking wow, Casey. Like, yeah, 20 pages. It's really
short
story.
It's like, well, right now, Jen just read this book that I am working on. And I was like, where am I going to send these behemoth, like, like, where are these going? I have no clue. You know, like, what am I going to do? Chop this up? Who knows? Right.
Where is this going? Is an act the actual like story?
Where could I send this in the world? I don't.
Oh, got
you know?
It. Right.
And you're just like nowhere, I guess. Whatever.
It's hard to do it, right? Like, oh, it's a book of short stories, and like, oh, okay. So you're like, yeah, they're all like 50, 60 pages long. They're like,
yeah, like I wrote 8 or 9 stories, and they're all super long. So everybody, get ready. Yeah, like
amazing.
It feels absurd. Yeah.
It's fine. I write like 8-page poems. It's fine. Nobody cares.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing. I'm also writing a long poem and I'm like, why are you doing this to yourself? What is wrong with your brain right now? Like, stop doing this.
That's like the thing though, right? You can kind of like feel when like, I think you can really feel when like the energy is sustained in something or it's not. And like,
absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like,
you know what I want to know? I want to know something because
let's hear it.
Casey, on your Instagram, you were wearing a very beautiful leather dress. And
yes, thank you.
Yeah, friends of the podcast.
I very much loved that comment.
Oh, let's definitely talk about the leather dress.
Friends of the podcast know Jen Sokfong-Li loves a leather dress. This is one of my favorite things in the whole world. And this is actually related to your book, though. There's a lot of clothing in these stories. And and your characters, you pay so much attention to what they're wearing, and I love it because I think sometimes writers will often forget to say what someone is wearing, you know, what they choose to wear, what's available to them, whether anyone's going to see it or maybe they're not going to see it. And there's all these sort of levels of what clothing can do. So is clothing like really important to you, like as a person? I'm curious. You read it beautifully. Like, honestly, like some of the clothing that your characters, I can see, especially when like Vera is transitioning and chooses to wear like a dress to work and all that's gorgeously done, written beautifully. I can see every single piece of clothing.
Thank you. Yeah. Clothing is very important to me. I would say like, and this is like a human, like I'm like wondering like as I'm not, I guess I didn't really like consider that much of like what that means as a writer. And I suppose I might have a more a real answer for that for you in a second. But as a person, like, oh my God, absolutely. I think I've always had extremely like particularities when it comes to clothing. And in terms of like what I like to put on my body and what I don't, and what I think like looks good on my body and what doesn't. For example, okay, when I was a kid, I couldn't deal with buttons. I could not wear anything with buttons. I was like, it was, and like, and to this, and like, you know, I've gotten over that. I'm an adult, you know, I can wear things with buttons if I have to.
You're putting on a smart button up if you have to.
Exactly. If I have to, but I had like a really like thing about it. Earlier this year, I was like, I'm going to buy 2 button-up dress shirts for when I need to wear something like that. And I like had to like psych myself up for it. It was like kind of like wild. I was like, I am a grown woman. Like, why is this so difficult? And I felt very, very big girl. But I'm also interested in like the ways that even like subtle shifts in clothing can make a difference on how people address you and how people think of you and how people treat you and how different types of people will interpret you. And like a lot of that is in my personal life, I became that was a lot, you know, I was very hyper aware of that when I was coming out and when I transitioned. But before that, and so But before that and after that, still, that's always something that interests me, and that's something I've taken notice in. I think also, it's been a long time since someone asked me about clothing. I remember I had a long talk with a friend about this like a decade ago. And I think I'm fascinated maybe by like the weird particularities of not just like how we like to dress in terms of like how we look, but also like how it like actually like feels on our bodies and how that actually like makes you feel good about yourself or not. In a lot of ways that I don't know if I can like explain or describe, you know, like I find it fast, like, you know, how sometimes like you like have stuff in your closet. You're like, oh yeah, why did I get that? That was so dumb. I'm never going to wear that again. I don't like that. But like, why? I can't even like explain that all the time. Or like, if I wear this, I feel gross. And then I'd be like, but why? It doesn't make any sense. Like, why do I feel that way?
It's
like,
also that like thing so too, weird, where you right? will put something on that makes you feel gross. And then someone will be like, you look great. And you're like, what's going on here?
I know. What?
You're like, why? Dude, why are you saying
this? Don't fuck with me.
Yeah,
why
absolutely.
Who are you trying to con, huh?
Absolutely. Well, like, I mean, it's like me and jeans and how I'm so weird about jeans. And I like constantly struggle to be like, I should get some just to be practical. And then I feel really mad about it.
Right. And then you're just like stuff like that. Absolutely.
Oh.
By the way, I also own no pairs of jeans.
Well, I do have the only pairs I have. I got in a clothing swap and I wear them to my garden.
Very practical. Very practical. Is this like a thing of like, okay, we're gonna do this because we have
to. Like, I'm a farmer now and I have to go to my garden. Like, that's what it is.
Amazing.
It's because I'm kneeling on the ground in dirt. Like, that's why.
Right.
Half my closet is jeans.
You look so cute.
Amazing.
I wear jeans every day. Yeah. I can't stop. I don't know. I love them. But then, like, it's fine. No, not everyone has to love them. I know. It's
so, just, I mean, and I know.
Like, really, like, this is the kind of stuff I'm interested in. Why? Like, do you like feel a certain way? Like, when you like are not wearing jeans, or like, is it like a part of like your daily activity? Is that a part of sort of like?
Yeah, there's two things. One of them is I'm usually walking my dog, and jeans are very practical for stuffing poo bags, keys, whatever it is you need, because there are pockets. And in addition, if another dog jumps on you and gets muddy paw prints on your jeans, it's fine. It'll come right out. No big deal. So there's that aspect. But the other thing, too, is I started wearing jeans. I remember my first pair of jeans. I was 8 years old, and they were from Fairweather, when Fairweather used to make children's clothes.
Wow.
And they were patch denim. Like, it would look like patches sewn together, like a quilt. And you could not tear those things off my body, because prior to that, the only things my mother let me wear to school were one of two sweatsuits. One was navy blue and one was gray. And then when I got these jeans, it was like a whole new world had opened up. I didn't have to wear my sweatsuits. This is a true story. Mrs. Lee, if you're listening, damn you, I only could wear those sweatsuits.
Jen, this is the absolute best thing, one of the best things you've ever shared.
So I think jeans mean to me like a whole opening up of the world, quite honestly.
Right.
Yeah.
See, I feel like
that makes a lot of sense. So much
of my childhood dressed inappropriately. I would be like, go in the shed, get a hammer, get some nails, go in the tree because we're going to build a tree fort. Guess what I'm wearing? My favorite dress. It didn't matter. I was like, oh, what if I wreck this? But I didn't. And that was the important part. Kept it pristine. Hammering into the cedar tree. Not a big deal. Everything's fine.
That is amazing.
Carrying old wood around. Like, where did it come from? Who knows? We didn't get tetanus. Everything's fine. It's fine.
I should actually clarify that. At some point, my mother also got me a summer weight sweatsuit that was teal. So I did have a thinner sweatsuit.
That actually sounds pretty nice, I got to be honest. Like a lightweight teal sweatsuit?
Yeah.
Amazing.
I feel like I would be into that now. Like, that's good. That's a good lounge wear
look. Actually, this whole rotation of sweatsuits I had, I wish I still had it.
See, this is the kind of shit I want to hear. I'm loving those.
Last year, Jen spent a long time researching a sweatsuit for her lockdown look.
It was my tie-dye sweatsuit. Yeah,
it's really cute.
Yeah, I love that sweatsuit.
Oh my god. Amazing. Amazing.
This is the best. You're about the best. This is really making me happy. Okay, I have another question. So Little Fish is a favorite of mine, and as a bookseller, a novel I recommend often. And I'd love to know how you approach writing short stories that feel similar or different to writing longer fiction, like a novel.
Gosh, yeah. I think that with, honestly, they've kind of all started out the same, where with Little Fish, I got about 40 pages into it. I started writing it thinking it was like going to be another long short story. And then I started writing it, and then I was like, oh, when I was about 40, 50 pages in, I was like, oh shit, like this is a novel. Like this is, I think this is a novel. Like, I think this is like, I have a lot more here. It's like, I'm going to have to write a novel.
This is a novel.
I know. Yeah. Oh no, this is going to be hard. And then like, there's definitely like enormous differences to me between novels and short stories about like curating a book of them and sort of like making that thing whole. But the beginning genesis of it, those to me have been like pretty similar, where I'm just kind of like, I don't know, fucking around in the brain minds being like, what's up with these people? Like, what's their deal? Like, what are they into? What's their problem? What's it like, that whole like little, just kind of like writing weird stuff and hanging out with them for a bit. Like that process is almost like, that process starts in, yeah, I would say like kind of the same ways. It's, and often ways I don't expect. Like one of the stories in A Dream of a Woman, Nicole's second story, Rose City, City of Roses, I had always thought, I had like sort of like had that story in my head for a long time, and I thought it was going to be this really long thing. I thought it was going to be like another like novella type thing, like over 100 pages. And when I actually sat down to write it, I was like, no, it just kind of came out like that. And it was, I think it's like 20 pages long. Let's see. Yes, 20 pages. So yeah, I don't actually know if I would say they're that, they've been that different. I think maybe with a story, I feel more comfortable like leaving a lot more stuff out. But then when doing like a book of stories, hello.
Hi, Oscar.
he just came in to interrupt.
Amazing.
Go away, child.
I love you, Oscar. We're going to hang
Hello,
out.
Hello, Oscar. It was nice meeting you for a second.
What a great kid.
Amazing.
Sorry, go ahead.
Honestly, this is like very comforting. This is very comforting, though, as someone who wants to finish this novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like, I think maybe I feel like they're more similar than I realize. Like, even too, yeah. Like, in terms of, like, finishing up a book of them, yeah. It's, like, the end stages. I was like, okay, like, what are, like, is there stuff here that was, like, raised that I want to address? Is there stuff here that I don't want to address? Is there stuff here that I want to kind of, like, leave an open-ended question? How do I do that effectively? Are there things I sort of want to close the metaphorical book on? How do I do that effectively? Blah, 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 blah. All those things are... like, thematically, aesthetically, those things felt similar in terms of, like, finishing the books themselves. And I very much feel like... I think this relates to an earlier question. I really, with short story collections particularly, I really love thinking of them as like an album, like a concept album, in terms of like what are you like starting off with? What's kind of like coming midway through? What's ending? And like where it like, how like the rhythm of it like flows from one end to another. I know like, I remember a couple times I've talked to authors who are like, oh yeah, the order of the stories. Like I didn't care. I just let someone else figure it out. And I was like, you are a chaos demon. Like that's
yeah. That's chaotic that evil.
Blows my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Well, also a poet would never do that. Like that they feel similar to me. Mm-hmm. The organization of a poetry collection, the organization of a collection of short stories. Like they have to have that album feel. Absolutely.
Yeah. Right.
Absolutely.
Okay. I am glad to hear that poets generally don't do that. That makes me
poets do that thing where they print their, I've never done this. Actually, I've done it once, where you print your manuscript out and you put the poems on the floor and you organize them.
That's amazing.
I did that. I did that with my two of my novels. I printed them out scene by scene. Uh-huh. And then you should have seen it. It took up my entire apartment.
Oh my God.
I feel
It helped me. Yeah. Because at that time, you know, I don't know how like anyone else writes fiction, but like I write them scene by scene, not necessarily in any kind of order, chronological order or otherwise. And I needed to be able to see, okay, so we're with this character here for X number of years, and then like put them all together so I can see where we're going. And then we've switched settings and this is what, you know, so I had to like organize it that way. Otherwise it's really difficult. I know people say that they use like software or different kinds of software to write that helps you do that. I have a really hard time seeing it unless I'm, you know, seeing it on the page. Rosie, my dog, is upset about something.
Rosie agrees.
Totally.
Yeah.
Well, Rosie, I think, is a good introduction.
Rosie's enthusiastically assenting.
Absolutely. Rosie's emotions, Jen's emotions. Jen, do you have some emotions to share?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. I'm getting my timer for you. Yeah, I've got your timer.
Okay. Rosie's going to do it with me. We're going to talk about change a little bit because, my partner and I are in the middle of combining households, which is a very scary thing for me. It's fine. I also started a new job, you know, where I had to learn like so many things about like business and publishing, which I didn't know before. And my life basically has seen a lot of change since Oscar was born, and like he's 11 now. And then there was a time not that long ago when I thought that there would be no more change. When I thought, you know, it's fine. I'm like 38. Nothing's going to change now. I'm going to be like this for the rest of my life. But I'm 45. And there's some pretty big changes and have been occurring for a few years now. And I used to say that I have a really restless soul, but I really honestly thought that I wouldn't have that anymore as I got older, like kind of like how Anne of Green Gables stopped feeling anxiety and rage when she got married. I thought that would happen to me. It didn't happen. So now I understand that I actually like change, and I actually like being a little bit restless, because what I like is the process of moving from one thing to the other, as opposed to actually getting to my goal. So I may never get to any destination of any kind.
Yeah.
There's 1 minute for you.
That was a perfect 1 minute.
Was it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That was really good.
That was.
Okay, Dina.
Yep.
Are you ready to rage?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay, let me get my timer on. Okay, ready?
Yeah.
Go.
Okay, I'm already cold and tired, and it's only the middle of September. I can't stand people who love fall but act like it's just wandering around in the crisp air looking LL Bean perfect while neon leaves are falling, sipping their PSL while they stroll in a bulky sweater. That is not West Coast fall. West Coast fall is soaking wet leaves, clogging drains, trying not to get splashed by cars rushing through street-side riverbeds at every corner, and your chunky cream knit turns you into a sopping wet loofah. And my number one enemy, Canada geese, don't even fly south anymore. They stay around all year long to shit on everything. Okay, what happened to cinnamon twist donuts? I am still chasing that feeling from the Fruitvale Bakery of my childhood. Also, the only reason I want to own a home is so that I can willy-nilly do what I like and get that donut wallpaper border that was at that bakery. Also, as always, the housing crisis. Fuck that shit. Also, the election sucks.
The election does suck. If I hear another person on the street interview where the journalist asks them something about being accused of being a racist and they get so mad and say, I'm not a racist, I'm like, I think you are. Because it hurts when they say so.
Just maybe. Just maybe.
Oh, it's too much.
Thank God it's over tomorrow.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I have a different 1 minute activity and then we're going to close this down. You have to answer these questions really fast.
Oh, right. Is this the game?
Yeah, it's really fast. It's called Would You Rather Fall Book Edition.
Goodness gracious.
Okay. One, attend a fancy gala or have a quiet bath at home.
Oh my God, attend a fancy gala.
Yeah, okay.
I don't like taking baths.
Same. I hate taking baths. They're terrible. Attend a Zoom event with your camera off or on.
Camera off.
Yeah, off.
Be on a panel with your nemesis or not be invited to any panels at all.
Oh, I just don't want to be on any panels. I would murder my nemesis. This is not... And then I'd be in prison. It would not be good.
This is very good.
No, I also choose no panels.
Great. Perfect. Sam, moderate a panel or be a panelist?
Oh, I
be
like...
Be a panelist.
I like moderating. Sorry, Casey.
No, that's fair. Okay.
Be a panelist. I hate moderating.
Yeah, fair. Next question. Bring pugilism back to writing and box In the Ring, a literary foe, or get into an op-ed off with another writer in a national newspaper.
Oh, my God. Okay, that's a tough one. I would lose the boxing match, so I'm going to say the op-ed off.
Okay.
Oh, you know what? I'll just box.
Same.
You know...
I also just want to box.
I'm small, okay. But I'm mean. It's fine.
Absolutely. You're going to fight dirty, and I want to see it.
See, I'm like the Midnight Blood would kick in. I'd be like, just why don't we? And then I would lose.
Yeah, that's honestly, I support you. I support both of you. Your choices are both valid. Between festival events, would you rather eat a squished Halloween fun-sized chocolate bar from the bottom of your bag or the crumbs of snacks in the hospitality suite?
Oh, that's such a good question. Chocolate bar.
Yeah, same. You don't know who's touched those crumbs?
No. Right? And, I mean, a Halloween fun-sized bar, even squished, is still delicious.
And I'm going to say there's nothing sadder than going to a hospitality room and eating, like, the last smoked salmon cream cheese pinwheel. Like, that's just
so sad. Right? Absolutely.
There's also, I feel like it's glorious. Okay. Like, so wait, am I interrupting you? Am I, like, fucking
no,
at the game?
No, it's fine.
Okay. There's something I feel like, there's something so, just, like, lizard brain delicious, definitely, about, like, eating those dregs of snacks, but I feel like it's such, like, a solitary individual thing. Like, I love eating every little last, like, fucking speck of dust from a bag of chips.
Absolutely.
But I have to be doing that, like, alone. I have to eat the entire bag of chips already myself, and it's, like, yeah. Preferably I'm in bed. You know what I mean? Like,
and then you dump the last bit, you dump it in.
Exactly.
Lick the fingers. Yeah, true.
Right, exactly.
Okay, there's only two questions. Have 7 minutes in heaven with Jonathan Franzen or read the new Fuck. Jonathan Franzen novel.
Fuck!
That's terrible. Okay. What are you doing, Dina?
Okay. You know what? It's hard being this hilarious. I don't know what to tell you both.
Actually, easy. Number one, because first of all, it will be 7 minutes, whereas reading the next Jonathan Franzen will take a lot longer. And
absolutely
first of
true.
All... you're going to have a really good story out of it, and like where you'll definitely will not have if you just read the book. You'll just have read a Jonathan Franzen book.
I fully 100% agree.
Amazing. You know what? I'm probably going to do both because that's the kind of sick little puppy I am. Okay, last question. At this magical event, there is no risk of getting COVID or sick at all. So would you rather consume all the remaining sweaty cubes of cheese from the end of a book launch, blend it into a smoothie with the last bits of all the warm beverages poured out of every plastic cup, or make small talk with someone you despise?
Fuck. Oh my God.
I think I would just do the small talk with someone I despise because I think I've done that 1,000 times already. I know I can do it.
Exactly. You're totally. It's just like the muscles there.
You're experienced. All right. Perfect. You're both amazing. And that's wonderful. Thank you for listening, everybody. You can find us at cantlit.ca. You can find us on Twitter at cantlit. I truly have not updated Facebook in so long, but if you go there, you can still get the link to the podcast and like, subscribe, give us 5 stars. We're almost at 100 episodes for free for you. We love you. You're the best listeners. You're doing great.
They're the best.
Sweeties. Casey, if people want to find you, where can they find you online?
I am on Twitter at Casey Plett, and I am on Instagram at Pletsky, which is Plett and then S-K-Y.
Right. And do you have a website?
I guess so. Yeah, CaseyPlett.com.
Okay.
It's like a WordPress that I update like once a year.
Yeah. It's okay. That's how I feel about mine, DinaDelBucchi.com. When do I update it? When I feel like it.
Right? Exactly.
Yeah, it's fine. Oh, this was so lovely, but we have one final question for you. Casey, what can't you with?
Oh, man. You know what I can't with? I'm very sorry. I know I'm going to make some enemies here. French flaps.
Ha!
Do not like them. Honestly, do not like them. Don't understand why they're there.
That's fair.
Yeah.
So you're
I also can't with places that no longer take cash.
Oh, ooh, absolutely. I agree. Mm-hmm. It's a real
French flaps and
yeah, these are
French
these
flaps
are,
and cashless institutions. Yep.
Definitely. Yeah. These are perfect. No, I just was going to say I love both of these answers. Casey, we love you so much. This was so wonderful. My only regret is that we are not in person. I've only got to spend one brief evening with you, and it was a delight.
It was so good.
It was really nice. Jen, I always love you. You're wonderful. I know you're late to go see your mom, and she's going to be so mad at me. So please don't tell her. But
she was just calling. I had to reject her call. She's going to be so mad.
Sorry, Jen.
Oh my God. We're in huge trouble with Mrs. Lee, and bad things are going to happen to us. We're definitely going to be cursed now. anyway, you're both wonderful. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And mwah, mwah, mwah. Goodbye. Thank you.
This was so good. So good. Thank you both.